The Society of Separatists, a militant atheist, the originator of the now famous Supreme Court suit that resulted in the 1963 school prayer decision, and the prosecutor of another suit which would tax all church property in the United States if the Supreme Court ruled in her favor. Also with us tonight is Dr. John Montgomery, chairman of the Church History Department at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School of Deerfield, Illinois, and author of many articles on church history and the death of God controversy. He's also written the book, The Is God Dead Controversy, which I'm sure we'll get into with Mrs. Murray or Mrs. O'Hare tonight. Madeline has been delayed for a few minutes, but she will be here, that I can guarantee. In the meantime, I'd like to spend a moment or so talking with Dr. Montgomery, who's the chairman of church history and also an article writer of many articles on religious history, and I believe that you are chairman of the Church History Department, and I think I've perhaps abbreviated your title somewhat.
Well, that's all right. There's no point in depressing the listeners with too long a title.
Well, let me say this. Madeline Murray has a very large title, too, and I want to give equal time where it's due. But
equal time principle extends to that, does it?
Yeah. I want to make sure that you've written many articles, I know, on church history and the death of God controversy, and why do you think that today, in asking ourselves, is God dead? It seems like sometimes a ludicrous question, is God dead? Why here and now, at this point in time, do you think we're asking this question of ourselves?
Well, I think there's several reasons for it. For one thing, Protestant theology has gotten itself in a very bad state as it's moved away from its biblical foundations. As the authority of Scripture has weakened, the doctrine of God has become vaguer and vaguer until finally it's difficult for some theologians to find him at all. I think there's a lesson in this, of course, and it is that if one moves away from Holy Scripture, one gets into serious difficulties all along the line theologically. And then also, we're in a secularizing era where people are attempting to be the masters of their fate and the captains of their soul to a far greater extent than ever before. So this comes in very nicely in conjunction with that. And then I think finally, this is a period when people sense the death of their own culture in many ways, and this is a kind of projection. At the end of the medieval period, there was a similar sort of thing where people concentrated on the dance of death when their culture was falling apart in various respects.
You mentioned that one of the reasons for the so-called death of God question today is the fact that we have deviated from Scripture. Would we be better off to have stuck with the Scripture?
Definitely, and if we had done this, we would be more on the intellectual main line as well as being more on the theological main line.
So Madeline is here. Better late than never. Nice to see you.
Well, I almost didn't come. I think I've undertaken a little bit too much these days, and I was so tired just now, I thought, well, I'm going to call you up and say I can't come.
I would have been really disappointed, and I know our listeners would have.
Yes, here I am.
Madeline, I want to begin with something I heard you say today, and I may, throughout the night, quote you from various things that people alleged you had said.
That's all right. I probably said it.
The Playboy interview of 1966, I think it was, or 65, a now famous interview. Some other things that you are purported to have said, so if from time to time I quote you, I hope you'll forgive me. One thing I heard you say this morning, when you appeared with Jerry Williams from 9 o'clock to 10, and you sort of ended the program with this comment, not only is God dead, but he is irrelevant. Would you explain that?
Did I say that this morning?
Yeah.
Later on, it seemed to me that what we were saying is that God isn't dead. He's in the White House. Or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Some theologians are saying he's in Selma.
Wow.
I don't think I said irrelevant. I said, I can't remember right offhand. But what I mean to say is this, that God is so thoroughly dead that it's like beating a dead horse to talk about him anymore.
All right, you did say that, by the way. Use that phrase, beating a dead horse.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Montgomery.
Dead to whom, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious all over that
no, it isn't obvious. That's why I'm asking the question.
I don't think that there has been any question for a long, long time, because I think it's a little over 6,000 to 8,000 years now that there have been arguments advanced as to the feasibility or the possibility or the probability of a god. This certainly was advanced by the Egyptians. It certainly was advanced by the old Chinese cultures, by the Indian cultures, long before your Christian god was ever invented. It was advanced in primitive communities all over the world. It certainly was advanced. Even the Indians in America had a great father.
There were
as many non-believers then as there are now.
Just out of curiosity, have you ever heard of what ethical philosopher G.E. Moore calls the naturalistic fallacy?
Yes, I have.
What is it?
Well, I'm going to let you define it because you brought it up.
I didn't think you were sure what it meant.
No, because there are some semantics here that I think that we can get involved in immediately. For instance, surely you or somebody else later is going to say, well, what is an atheist? And I think that
I'm going to lead off with the definition. What the naturalistic fallacy is. All right, Dr. McGarry, if you would define. Yes, the naturalistic fallacy is the incorrect conclusion.
Now, this is your interpretation of Moore's naturalistic philosophy, or are you going to use
a quotation
from
G.E. Moore in the Principia Ethica, Chapter 1, defines the naturalistic fallacy as the fallacious kind of argument which attempts to justify a thing by its origin. Now, this is a pretty silly thing. For example, we can show that chemistry originated in alchemy in the attempt to change lead into gold. Now, this was a very unfortunate idea, but that doesn't negate chemistry. Now, by the same token, if you can show that people have had some very primitive ideas of God, that says nothing whatever about the validity of the idea of God.
Well, yes and no.
Yes, not no.
No, yes and no. It's very, very, very definitely a matter of interpretation and the position that you want to take in relation to this.
This is a fallacy regardless of interpretation. It's a logical
fallacy. No, it isn't a fallacy in regard to interpretation at all, because I think that for instance, there can be various interpretations of other things than those that than this that you pick out for an example, and that this particular thing is true regardless of the person who discovered it or invented it or interpreted it.
No, I didn't say it was true regardless of who invented it. I said the question of the origin of it is irrelevant to the question as to whether it's
true.
All
right. The same thing. It doesn't matter. You can put it into whatever words that you desire to put it in, and
I'll
put it in.
Right. So for this reason, there was no point in bringing up the fact that primitive people have some odd religious ideas. The question is simply whether God exists.
Well, whether or not God exists, though, has nothing to, in one sense. If one has to historically look at the origins and the development and the use of God, and God has been invented because there was a specific use for him along the way.
That's an interesting statement of faith. What gives you the idea that God was invented in order to satisfy human need?
I didn't say that.
To affirm it doesn't make it so.
No, I didn't say that. I said that God was invented so that he could be used. I'm not saying that he was invented for human need. I think that he was invented, for one thing, to control people.
It isn't an interesting idea at all. It's an historical fact.
I don't think, for instance, that...
You mean in the same way as you can discover that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, one can go to a point of history and point out that there God was invented for one reason or another? Now, really...
Yes, I think that there have been some fairly decent researches.
You want to point out some specific facts instead of vague researches?
No, do you mind if I say something? I'm perfectly willing to go on. I think that, for instance, I would accept the volumes of work done by Fraser, his Golden Bough, as a possible valid historical interpretation of the beginnings of the ideas of a God in various phases and in various cultures, etc. I think that he perhaps has done one of the most respectable kind of searchings that has been done.
What exactly is Fraser doing? Would you mind indicating for the
radio audience? I have no idea what Fraser is doing right now.
No, I don't mean what he's doing now. I'm sure he's home in bed. I mean, what the purpose of his work was.
Well, now, this, again, is open to interpretation. Those persons who are of my persuasion feel that what he was doing was trying to show an evolutionary thing here in relation to not primitive, but...
If I can just jump in here for a second, I think that most of the people listening will not really be conscious of who Mr. Fraser was or who Mr. Moore was. Let me ask you this, Madeline, if I may call you Madeline. Are you basing your atheism basically on the fact that you cannot logically prove the existence of a God?
Oh, no. Because one cannot logically prove the existence of electricity, I presume, or one cannot logically prove the existence of atomic energy, or one cannot logically prove what life is. So that it is, in essence, in part, it's logical, in part, it's intuitive, in part, it's a result of my own adventures or misadventures in living, and from looking at the human animal and the nature in which he thrives or doesn't thrive, and trying to interpret from this and trying to interpret from the events of human history whether or not there has been or could have been such a figure. And always I come up with an overwhelming answer. And I think that all people of inquiring mind who go about this with perception, depth, feeling, understanding, emotion. I come up with the same thing. There's a terrible struggle to find, say, meaning in life, meaning in death, meaning in the various philosophical systems, meaning in the processes that we see, the processes of age, for instance, meaning in birth, meaning in why do we go to work every day? Why struggle as terribly as some of us do for just an existence? Why worry and fret like you do, for instance, over your program into giving it birth and causing it
you
to grow?
You look common enough to me.
Hey. I'm sure you might accuse religionists of being dogmatic, correct? you would accuse them of that,
wouldn't
you?
Their stock and trade is dogma.
Okay, their stock and trade is dogma, but are not you as an atheist really in the stock and trade of dogma, too?
What dogma do I have?
The dogma that there is, in fact, absolutely no God.
Who said that?
You said that.
No. You see, nobody knows what an atheist is, and nobody knows what an atheist says no matter how often they listen to us. What we say is this. Anybody who says that they have absolute positive proof that there is a God is crazy as hell. They should be put in a nut house.
Well, do you
now,
have...
just a moment.
All right, okay, go ahead.
Anybody who has absolute positive proof that there is no God is just as bad off.
All right, then you are an agnostic.
No, I'm not an agnostic. No, don't tell me what I am. I'll tell you. What we are saying, though, is that we will order our lives as if there is no God. We will order our lives as if there is no hereafter. We will order our lives as if we cannot supplicate any supreme being to intervene into our lives and to change our lives. We will be in command of ourselves. We will stand on our own feet, think our own thoughts, and live our own lives. This is what an atheist says.
Sounds very creedal to me.
It isn't creedal at all. And you know it. This has nothing to do with a creed. This has nothing to do with dogma. This has nothing to do with ritual. This has to do with a person's ability to handle their own affairs, taking together all of their experiences in living, their education, their whole background, their parents' background, everything that has been given to them, and to order their lives in a direction which will bring them fruition in their thinking, in their physical life, in their intellectual and emotional lives, and to use this fruition for what we feel is a positive thrust toward fulfillment, life fulfillment.
Well, I think
can I just
have it
very
helpful.
10 seconds, and I'm going to use a quote that Dr. Montgomery used just before we went on the air, and just before Mrs. O'Hare got here, and you said she is ignorant, and I'd like to have Dr. Montgomery explain that, and I'm sure you'll react to it.
Yes, I said that. Someone once said, and I think this applies quite well to Mrs. Murray, I wish I knew as much... Oh, pardon me, Mrs. O'Hare. I wish I knew as much about anything as she knows about everything. And I thought it was very helpful that just before the break here, she defined her atheism, described it in terms which makes it perfectly clear that this is simply a statement of faith. It's her own creed. It isn't based upon factual evidence. And when we come down to questions of fact, Mrs. Murray has a way of fudging. And I call this ignorance, particularly when she goes around the country maintaining her position on such a flimsy basis as this.
No, I think ignorance is not having facts accessible upon which one can base a conclusion. And everybody has areas of ignorance. You have them as well as I have them. And I don't presume to talk about those things which are based in ignorance. But I do presume, and as I said to you during the break, I will not permit you tonight to say to me, well, we're going to talk about Moore's concepts, and Mrs. Murray, you therefore define Morris concepts. Anything that you have do decide that you're going to bring into this controversy, you can define. And anything that I decide that I want to bring into it, I'll be willing to define on my terms. You on your terms.
Maybe
so that we won't
have
any.
Fact something to do with it, too. That wouldn't work.
Come on, a fact like what?
All right, let me jump in here and throw a fact out. Mrs. O'Hare, Madeline, you said that at one time in your now-famous Playboy interview that Jesus did not exist. There is no evidence that he even existed as an historical figure.
That's right. There is no evidence that Jesus Christ existed as an historical person. The only evidence that the theologians have been able to come up with is an interpolated passage in Josephus and an expression of opinion in Tacitus. And this whole business of Tacitus has been run down in at least, well, I've read 3 volumes myself on his references, and one of the things
Well, would you mind telling me what those are?
No, I don't recall the names.
Well, what about the 4 Gospels?
Yeah?
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John had something to say.
They sure did. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not historical documents. They are expressions of a religious faith.
What is a historical document?
Well, I think that at the time that Jesus Christ existed, I would take the Senate records in Rome.
Uh-huh. In other words, only Senate records are historical documents.
No, that's not true, and you know it. I think that I would take almost any kind of evidence that has been brought up in any kind of historical research or...
You're begging the question. We're trying to find out what is historical research. We're wondering if these gospel records are historical or not. You apparently feel that you'll take anything else, but you won't take them.
Dr. Martelli,
now, wait. Why did everybody get so excited about the Dead Sea Scrolls? And I mean the religious community, and of course I did too. They got excited about the Dead Sea Scrolls because they thought, aha, finally, here is something that may date either from that period or close to that period, which will substantiate the story of Jesus Christ. And they felt, all right, here finally is the proof. But
Excuse me, but are you saying that all the people who are interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls didn't feel that there was one scrap of historical evidence about Jesus before that time, and that perhaps the Dead Sea Scrolls would provide this sort of thing?
See, you, as all persons who are religious, you delight in putting words in my mouth.
I'm not religious. I'm Christian.
There's a difference, believe me. No Christian is religious, or no person who professes to be Christian is religious.
Sounds like dogma again.
Well,
but go ahead. We're trying to figure out what constitutes a historical record as far as you're concerned.
I think that, as I said, the Senate records, I think that anything written by an historian of the period would take cognizance of this. I think that Josephus is regarded as an historian of the religious faith by you. I don't regard him as such as an historian because I think he was as confused in many areas as...
you brought him up. I didn't bring him up.
Well,
what we're trying to determine is whether the gospel records would constitute historical material or not.
They do not. They have not been recognized as any historical reference to Jesus Christ by any scholars of any importance in any historical field in the United States. Except your Ph.D.s and your Th.M.s and so on.
Let me read you a quotation from Sir Frederick Kenyon, who is the principal librarian of the British Museum.
I don't care who he is.
Well, let's
he's
hear
not
the statement
an
anyhow. Well, let's
me.
Hear
well,
the statement anyhow. He didn't have a Ph.D. What do you mean he is an authority to you? You
don't
know
accept
how...
him as an authority.
In spite of the fact that he was the principal librarian
I
of the British
tell,
Museum.
But the reason that he's the principal librarian in this particular museum is most probably because he supports the status quo of Christianity.
Well, can we lay any ground rules down as to what fact is and what isn't fact?
Which happens to be the British National Library, the librarian of that, turns out to be in this position because he's a Christian believer?
No, are you meaning to say to me that a good...
That's incredible.
No. Are you meaning to say to me that a good solid atheist could turn up as the head of this particular museum... Or as the head of...
Madeline, in all fairness, you're assuming a lot of things about a man you don't know. You don't know him, I don't know him. Let's hear what he has to say.
I'm not interested.
Well,
I don't think anybody
maybe
is interested
the radio audience
in
might be interested.
Particular so-called authority that you designate as an authority, and I don't care whether he is or not.
Let's just assume he's a man who's a librarian. Let's hear what he has to say, that's all.
Yes, this gentleman, at the time of his death in 1941, was the foremost authority in textual criticism, in classical textual criticism.
Now, that's your idea, because I don't accept this.
Check it out at any university. Check it out among the atheists at any university.
I will be glad to check it at any university. It seems to me that the German theologians in the 1800s who did the specific researches in relation to the four Gospels were probably the...
What historians, specifically?
Well, let's get to the
here again,
You're totally ignorant of it.
Wait a minute.
I'll be glad to send you a list of books from my Texas library if you want to wait that long. I don't carry these in my head.
Please, Dr. Montgomery, read whatever this man has to say, and we won't presume that it's either true or false.
He's a Christian,
right?
Jew, an atheist.
Right. Just read it, please.
Yes. Kenyon, at the end of a lifetime of research in this area... in dealing with the
let him finish, please.
I have no idea whether he was a Christian. I'm not interested in whether he was a Christian. I'm interested only in the value of his work as a textual critic dealing with documents of the first century.
Okay.
The interval between the dates of original composition of the four Gospels and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be, in fact, negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the New Testament documents have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established.
Oh, that's naive. And you know it.
Well,
what you're doing is taking a Christian historian who wants to support a thesis or a tenet that he has and who backs this up by the respectability of his so-called job. This is all. This is an opinion.
We don't know.
Is this an opinion or is this a statement of historical truth? It's an opinion of his.
Would you like to come down to the data on which he bases this? Here is some of the data, for example. The distance between the writing of New Testament documents and the fullest text that we have is 250 to 300 years. Now, this compares with 1,300 years for Plato, 1,200 years for Demosthenes, and that gap.
Jump in here. Dr. Montgomery, with all due respect to the good librarian, and I don't think you're going to convince Madeline Murray O'Hare, if you cite on ad infinitum,
I think you're quite right, because it's a question of whether Mrs. O'Hare, with no knowledge of the field, is going to be the authority, or whether Kenyon, with a lifetime of work in the field, is going to be the authority.
I don't have to rely on memorizing a list of names of so-called authorities. For instance, I don't have to say, all right, the historian Turner in American history said this and said this and had a theory.
Yeah, well, he'll your thesis doesn't have anything
back
to do with
the West. Now, wait a minute. And that, therefore, I am going to accept this. What I say is this is this man's interpretive opinion of particular events. And this is what you have here. You have an interpretive of so-called historical events. You can offer no proof, no extant evidence that either the four Gospels have come down to us extant, and they have no errors in them, and you can offer no evidence of the historicity of Jesus Christ. You have nothing.
Let's take an analogy that would maybe remove the heat a bit. Let's take, for example, the problem of whether Caesar crossed the Rubicon or not. Now, how would you determine whether or not he did? What kind of documents would you regard as historical documents in relation to that problem?
What you're doing is, this is a true example of begging the question. I'm asking you for concrete historical proof that Jesus Christ ever existed in whatsoever form
as
a historical person, and you answer and you say, well, we can't prove that
Caesar crossed
the Rubicon. I mean, this is...
What I'm trying to do, of course, is to point out that your rejection of these New Testament documents would force you to reject other historical documents which you accept without any difficulty at all.
No, I don't. You don't know whether I accept these or not. Just a moment. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I got quite involved in along the way was the history of historiography, which I studied at Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio.
That's interesting. I've done a book in the field. Maybe you could tell us something about that.
Now, just a moment till I finish this. And I think that it's patently clear that those persons, for instance, in southern United States are going to report the Civil War in one way, and that those persons in the northern United States are reporting the Civil War in another way, each from their own inner substantive opinion and judgment. you are going to look at these historical documents as a Christian who wants to support your tenet and your thesis, and you are going to find in these, in a multiplicity of unrelated or perhaps faintly interrelated items, an overwhelming proof to you, because this is the kind of argument which you accept and which you will hold. I will look at these same things and reject them out of hand as being non-connected or as being some other thing. And this may be from my personal bias just as well. But the thing is that I will admit that I have a personal bias and that I come to these subjectively, and you won't.
Mrs. O'Hare talks about the Civil War as a result of a course in historiography. She points out that...
No, not as a result of that course. I'm just pointing it out right now.
She points out that people in the North and people in the South arrive at different interpretations of the Civil War. And this is quite true. But the point at issue is whether either side, unless it had lost its mind, would argue that because of these differences of interpretation, there wasn't any Civil War. Now, this is exactly the point in regard to the gospel records.
No,
it's quite true
it's
that
nothing
people,
like it, and you know it.
In the case of the gospel records, it's quite true that people take different interpretations of considerations in these records. But the real issue is, are these historical documents which can give us data about the man Jesus, who claimed not only to be a man, but also to be God in the flesh, and who based this claim on a resurrection which he then actually engaged in? Now,
well,
this,
you know, I claim to be the Virgin Mary in the 17th resurrection, so this means nothing. I don't care what Jesus Christ said.
I didn't hear that.
I've often made a claim to be the Virgin Mary in her 17th resurrection.
Well, there's a showstopper.
Yes, we're all
really,
impressed
by that.
There's a quote that I want. Have you risen from the dead?
Let me tell you what this is all about. We started this out. Let me resume here. We started this out by your saying to me that there is a God, which was invented 1,600 years ago. You reject all of the other gods, of course. They're fallacious. There was, because they were non-Christian. So you reject Allah, you reject all of the gods of Egypt, you reject the gods of India, you reject the gods of China, you reject the gods of South America, you reject the gods of the American Indian, and you say, well, all of those people were just deluded persons who didn't know what they were doing.
No, that's not true at all.
Well, now, wait a minute, because yours is Christianity.
I thought you felt that it was unwise for me to put words in your mouth. Now you're trying to tell me what I said. Of course, I said nothing of this kind.
No, what I'm saying, let me finish this, please. All right, and then I'll yield to you whatever mistake I had in interpretation of
thus far, it's been all mistakes, but go ahead.
Well, this is, again, name-calling of sorts. But this point is that there have always been gods. There have always been non-believers in these gods. And the particular God theory that has an ascendancy in the United States is the Christian God theory. But there is still extant this theory of Allah. You would know more. Let me present historical proof here, so-called, of the absolute historical beginnings of Allah and his prophets.
Before you go on,
you would say that this is... go ahead.
Excuse me, but before you go on, don't get yourself in a very serious pickle. I've got an article in the Muslim World of April 1961 dealing with this very question of the evidences in behalf of the Muslim God as compared with the evidences in behalf of the Christian God. Now,
then you do admit at least that there are these two God theories current.
Well, this court depends on what you mean by theory.
Well, let's not get hung up defining the word theory. Let me just switch tracks for a minute and get off this particular kick. And if I can use another of Madeline's quotes in the Playboy interview of a couple of years ago.
I'm going to have to do a new one because we need some new quotes.
Okay, try this one. The history of the church has been a history of divisiveness, repression, and reaction.
Yeah, I don't need to add anything.
Well, Dr. Montgomery, would you agree that the history of the church has been one of divisiveness, repression, and reaction?
No, he will read a minute paragraph from an authority saying that it isn't
true.
Now,
wait a minute. Let's not
stand by
what he's going to do.
How about a 19th century rationalist, somebody who certainly Mrs. O'Hare would consider to be in her camp? This is W.E. Leckie. Who did a two-volume work on the history of morals.
In my camp, but go ahead.
Said he, the character of Jesus has not only been the highest pattern of virtue, but the strongest incentive to its practice, and has exerted so deep an influence that it may be truly said that the simple record of 3 short years of active life has done more to regenerate and soften mankind than all the disquisitions of philosophers and all the exhortations of moralists. And I imagine you would include
You don't really believe that. The rantings and the contradictory holdings out
of Jesus Christ has caused more misery in our modern era than anything else, and you know it.
You want to give some concrete facts, or do you want to bring in the level of stupid generalization?
Now, come on.
Well, let's have a cut.
I'm not calling you stupid, although I have my own opinions of your abilities. I will not say anything in relation to this, but would you sit there and say that the Inquisition was a blessing to man? Would you sit there and say that
did Jesus advocate the Inquisition?
Did this or did this not stem from an application of his teachings and an interpretation of them by the religious community?
That's guilt by association, and you know it. Just because a communist brushes his teeth is no reason I'm going to knock mine out. And by the same token, simply because some people who went under the name Christian performed some ghastly acts says nothing whatever about the teachings of Jesus.
Whether or not you will accept the history of your own church, it is there. These people acted as Christians.
Well, wait a minute. They did not act
these
as Christians.
These people acted as Christians. They interpreted your Bible. They were working through the Bible. They were working through the sayings of Jesus Christ.
No, they were
not alone for the Inquisition.
They were living in a period when they had very little contact with the Bible.
Just a moment. What was one of the biggest supports of slavery in the South from every Baptist pulpit? You know as well as I do.
Maybe it was the verse in Scripture, there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither bond nor free, but ye are all one in Jesus Christ. Or maybe the verse, God is no respecter of persons.
You know that this is not true. You know that the Baptists, certainly in the South, relied greatly, as much as they possibly could rely, on the Bible to enforce slavery. You know that keeping the women from the vote was supported, certainly, right down the line by the churches.
What passages in the Bible are against the women voting?
This isn't it. It's what your representatives do in each era interpret.
If there's clear teaching of the Bible against women voting or in favor of slavery, then you ought to be the first one to point it out. And then we could see that actually Jesus is responsible for this sort of thing.
Now, come on. Number one. You know exactly what I'm referring to.
You don't know the Bible well enough to be able to quote John 3:16 in a dark alley.
I'm not the least bit interested in quoting whether it's John or Leviticus. I'm not interested in that because this is minute nitpicking and it's picayune.
It's a matter of fact, and nitpicking turns out to be any fact that contradicts unfounded opinion.
No. Whether or not I am able to cite verse and number tonight.
Oh, don't bother with verse numbers. Just give us the passages.
Just a moment. Will you listen to me a moment? Whether or not I have brought a library with me, such as you have, or whether I have not have brought, whether or not I have brought voluminous notes, is neither here nor there. The whole point that is necessary is that this is the particular interpretation. This is the philosophy. This is the basis of those things which the Christian church has over a strong number of years.
That's what we're trying to determine. Merely you're saying it over and over doesn't make it the case. The question is whether or not you can support it.
The church didn't do a damn thing to Galileo, did it? Because they weren't really Christians. They were interpreting it wrongly. But you now, in 1967, you can interpret it correctly because you have absolute knowledge on this. You have substantive historical records on this. And you can therefore say, Joan of Arc was a mistake. The Inquisition was a mistake. The burning of witches in Massachusetts, we're sorry, but they weren't really interpreting Christianity. You can say that the suppression, certainly, of women, and I am a woman suffragette or whatever the hell you want to call me. I'm swearing tonight.
I wish you'd watch it. This is a family show, Madeline. And the kids are not in bed yet.
No, I'm tired.
Please.
I'm tired.
You're tired. Well,
I'd hate to have my David and Elizabeth hear how an atheist can't control herself.
Yeah. Well, let me go on. Uncontrolled, as it were. The point is this. You can sit there now, and you can say, all right, they were not interpreting this correctly. We have the last word. We know what Jesus Christ meant. And we know what he said, and we know that these errors were errors of the church. That when Luther revolted, he was really revolting against something else. He wasn't revolting against those particular things that he said was revolting against. But this was because of his psychological interpretation and the fact that the church was not representing the true Christian principles. Come on, this is idiotic.
Well, that last statement certainly was, and it was followed by a series preceding it. We're not talking about the question of Luther's revolt as to whether it was psychological or not. We're simply talking about whether it's possible to attribute to Jesus all of the errors that Christians have performed through the ages. Now, it's very silly to do this. You know perfectly well that in any movement, including the American Association for the Advancement of Atheism, there are poor examples and fellow travelers. And to condemn the ideas as a result of looking at the poor representatives is bad logic, and it really isn't even worth presenting. It really is beneath the dignity of a program such as this for you to use arguments of that kind.
No, you see, here again is your idea that always you can sweep away with words, or you can sweep away with pseudo-logic, those representatives, that expressive representation of religion throughout the years. You can sweep away, for instance, the fact that religious principles are called upon right now by the administration in order to justify the war in Vietnam. And you can say, well, those spokesmen for the administration who are doing this justification for the war in Vietnam are not interpreting Jesus Christ's words literally, or that they are not interpreting the essence and the meaning of Jesus Christ. Or you can say, well, maybe they are, depending on which verse of Jesus Christ you want him to take up the sword or whether you want him to turn the other cheek. So that you can go ahead with these interpretations. But this only means that you're agile in rationalization in order to support your position, and that you will support your position no matter how you have to stretch facts. You will support your position no matter how you have to stretch logic and how you have to support this by a mass of other misinterpretations and rationalizations that have been piled up through history by persons who are interested in sustaining and supporting this.
Speaking of turning the other cheek, I would like for us to turn the other cheek and talk a little bit about your now famous Supreme Court suit, which has really caused a great deal of attention and controversy in the country, which took Bible reading out of and prayer out of public schools, and about your current suit, which would have the government tax churches. Now, in 1963, the Supreme Court, Madeline, ruled on your now-famous suit to ban prayers in public schools. Why did you, in the first place, ever bother with such a suit?
Well, because my son was then age 14, and he felt that since he was not interested in religion at that particular time, that he should not be forced to read from the King James Version of the Bible and to say the King James Version of the Lord's Prayer. And he came to me and told me that he wasn't interested in doing this anymore. And I told him more or less fundamentally that this was his problem. And his rejoinder to me was that if I was an atheist, I had to be a person of my convictions. And that a person of their convictions moves on their convictions. And if they do not move on their convictions, but only hold them verbally, that they were hypocrites. So he said if I was an atheist, it appeared to him that I would support his efforts to stop his reading and of the Bible and recitation of the Lord's Prayer in the public schools. So he himself made a complaint to the schools, and I supported him in this complaint. The schools, of course, ignored him, so then I made a formal protestation. And after this, then I made a litigious protestation through the courts in Baltimore City. But substantially, I did this for my son. He was, the case was William J. Murray III. Against the city of Baltimore. He was 14 years at the time. The case bears his name, not mine.
Dr. Montgomery, what are your feelings towards prayer in public schools?
It's very difficult for me to agree with Mrs. O'Hare, but I think that she has made a very important point in the matter of the separation of church and state. I think that the blending of church and state is always an unfortunate thing. It's an unfortunate thing whether one looks at it from the standpoint of religion, or from the standpoint of a position such as Mrs. O'Hare's. I think that it's too bad when people who do not believe in God are forced by state action to go through religious rites or ceremonies. This is an imposition on their freedom of conscience, and I think that
why
such a thing is very
unfortunate.
Why didn't
you start this suit, then? Why didn't your institution start this suit 20 years ago? Why did you wait on me?
Well, you see, I was spending my time trying to learn something about historical matters of the kind we were talking about earlier so that I wouldn't appear on this program in total ignorance.
No, that isn't an answer.
Yes, it is.
That's a smart remark.
No, it's not an answer.
It's a very smart remark.
All right, answer a smart remark. Let me get something out of a paper called Debate on Parents' Rights. This is put out by the Parents' Rights Fund, Court Fund. They're out of St. Louis, Missouri. Speaking of Madeleine Murray, they say a conservative guess is that about 50 million people in the United States would like to tell Mrs. Madeleine Murray a few things about their rights. It just doesn't seem right that she should be the one to have all the rights, especially when she is so wrong about God. 50 million people can't be wrong, or can they? Now, what this article is saying is that most parents would like prayer in public schools.
Most parents would not like prayer. There has been a concerted effort since 1963 by religious organizations spearheaded by the Catholic Church, which has aligned itself with fundamentalist groups. But the major religious denominations of those, quote, respectable religions, of which, unfortunately...
Are you excluding Catholicism from respectability? That's a strong statement, especially in Chicago.
Well, I was thinking in terms of the Protestant religion in this particular instance, because I had already ruled out the Catholics and the fundamentalists,
okay,
who have joined together in order to be coercive into introducing this. They have attempted at one time they were going to get a petition of 2 million signatures to present to their representatives. They have tried every conceivable kind of pressure, thousands of telegrams, telephone calls, repetitious letters signed by persons, petitions upon which the names of dead persons and et cetera have appeared. They have tried everything that they could to muster enough support to get the Becker Amendment through, and now, of course, the senator from Illinois is spearheading this drive in order to get what is equivalent to the Becker Amendment put into the into the Constitution as yet, because it would have to be voted on through the states in order to do this, but at least to start the legal procedure for this. And they have not been able to muster this. Now, if everyone was enthusiastically involved in getting Bible and prayer back into the schools of America, I think that this would be able to be accomplished. Or if God was on their side, surely he would intervene and help them. They'd send up enough prayers.
You know, that makes me think of Robert Ingersoll, who used to get on platforms and give God 30 seconds to strike him dead. And then when God didn't do this, Ingersoll concluded with the eminent logic that I think you've been displaying in this room, that there was no God. Fact is, God has plenty of time, Mrs. O'Hare, plenty of time.
All right, the Supreme Court ruling on prayers in public schools now is ancient history, even though there are a great many people who are fighting it.
I'd enjoy coming back, though, to this point of ethics for just a minute. A person who doesn't believe that there is any eternal word from outside the human situation to indicate
you
what
really
we ought to follow ethically or not is bound to pick up his ethic culturally from the social situation. And such people, and you're a representative of this, Mrs. O'Hare, are very dangerous because their ethic can move according to the social situation. In the 1930s in Germany, the cultural setting was such that it was possible to justify genocide. In our cultural situation, thank heaven, you've picked up the Christian ethic, even though you won't admit it, and therefore you're not dangerous in that way.
I would like to, again, use one more quote. I promise this is the last one I'll use. Last one I'll use, and it really is...
Not quite quotable.
You are.
Yeah.
You are.
He's not quoting you.
I know. He may.
This had to do with a comment you made in...
he is quoting you.
A well-known men's magazine.
Which shall remain nameless.
Regarding sex.
Yeah.
I think young people should be able to have their first sexual love affair whenever they feel like it. In the case of most girls, this would be around 13 or 14. With most boys, around 15 or 16. I'd like to get Dr. Montgomery's reaction to that.
Marriage is something far more worthwhile than would be indicated by the kind of easygoing attitude towards sex that's suggested here. The sexual experience is an experience which ought to take place in an atmosphere of total commitment and trust. It isn't the sort of thing where one cat snuggles up with another cat. And I think it's a perfect example of what I was saying just before the break, that when one leaves the kind of ethic that Jesus presented, one gets into the most unpleasant kind of situations where one loses respect for things that are simply marvelous and holy.
Well, I'm glad that you think sex is marvelous. I'll go along with you down that far, but I won't say that it's holy. Well, there's a pun there that I'll skip.
Please skip that pun.
But
she's going to get us cut off yet.
No, the point here that I'm trying to make is that nature, I think, is a much better regulator of our activities.
Sounds like you're personifying nature. Is that with a capital N or a small N?
Again, well, I'm not going to comment. Nature dictates when sexual activity is ripe with all of the animals.
Nature doesn't dictate anything. We as human beings make decisions in terms of the natural environment. Nature doesn't force anything on us.
I was talking about cows right now.
I was afraid that you were classing human beings with cows. That's the reason for that kind of sex ethic.
No, I'm talking about the fact that we are physiologically ready to undertake certain experiences in life in certain age groups.
Let me ask you a question. Men begin growing beards around the, beginning to get hair on their face around age 12. Now, I imagine that since that's natural, one should never cut any hair off his face.
There are a number of persons who are not
cutting hair off. Nature dictates that we ought to keep hair on our face, in other words, as nature dictates that we ought to begin a sex experience as soon as we're capable of it. Is that right? Is that the kind of logic you use?
No, but if you want to cut the hair on your face, this is your business. The fact is that the hair is there, isn't it?
Oh, quite right. And
now, what
and
you
the sexual
do with
urge
it, now,
is very definitely there, but that doesn't mean that we ought to employ it.
What you do with the hair is your business. You can't stop it from growing.
Oh, quite right, quite
You've
right.
You've either got to cut it off or let it grow and do something with it and braid it.
Oh, one
it
must
grows.
Do something with it. The question is, what do we do with it?
All right, now, no, the whole point is that it is there. Now, the same thing when one reaches an age of sexual maturity. We have a problem in our society as to what one should do at this particular time. I feel that one should do what is natural to do.
Oh, now here you're confusing what happens to be present, namely a sexual urge, with what we ought to do about it. Nature doesn't dictate what we ought to do with
it. Nature dictates that we should do one of two things with this urge. We should either satisfy it ourselves or satisfy it through an expression with a sexual partner. In one case, you have masturbation. In another case, you have intercourse.
In other words, you suggest that the only possibilities for handling the sex urge are intercourse or masturbation.
These are the methods that human beings use, whether they tell you about it or not.
These are the only possibilities. It isn't possible, for example,
to
do either of these.
To suppress this completely, have you been in any of our insane asylums recently? Do you see what happens
not
when
suppress,
people...
suppress, sublimate, and there's a great difference between these two things.
There is not a great difference.
If you had any background in psychology, you'd realize that not using the sex urge is not the same thing as repressing it. Do you really think that every person who doesn't have sexual intercourse at the age of 13 or 14 is repressed?
They are repressing a sex urge. They are doing
something. You're pontificating, and you don't like popes.
Incidentally, I hate to disturb you about this, but I have a master's degree in psychiatric social work, so I do know the difference between sublimating.
Well, this doesn't say much for the kind of training you received if you are willing to place all sublimation in the category of repression.
If I may, sublimate the conversation for a moment. Have your headpieces on, and we'll take our first call. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, I'd like to address myself to Dr. Montgomery.
Go ahead.
Dr. Montgomery is talking about when Mrs. Murray mentioned that persecution in the religious establishment has run rampant through history, and he said it was only a small fringe, lunatic fringe, or so he said. Well, I disagree with that. I say that when persecution has happened, such as the Inquisition, it has been the entire religious establishment of that time. It's not been just a small fringe. And those who disagreed with the majority opinion there were the ones who were persecuted. And forget persecution for a moment. I contend that the religious establishment has been stagnant in taking stands on moral issues as a whole. Now, individual priests, for instance...
Wait a minute. Let's not make a speech here. You've made 2 points already. Let Dr. Montgomery answer them, okay?
All right.
Thanks.
The question of persecution can't be tied to religion in the way in which Mrs. O'Hare has done or in the way in which you're doing. The fact of the matter is, as Lord Acton said, power corrupts and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And this means that human beings, wherever they are, in whatever circumstances, if they are not in the kind of relationship with God that they ought to be, whether or not they're members of a religious establishment or not, will grind down people in a less advantageous position. Now, you can find instances of persecution in a religious context. You can find instances of persecution in a non-religious context. For example, Dachau and Buchenwald can hardly be attributed to religious persecution. And there you have probably the greatest examples in human history of the devastation of... well, the religious community there is on the receiving end. What you're trying to maintain is the religious community is on the giving end.
Well, may I...
They didn't have any Jews who were guards there who were rounding up the Jews.
Can we pass persecution over? I think even perhaps the greater problem, the greater failure of the religious establishment is its stagnancy in speaking out on moral issues of the day, for instance, civil rights.